Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
She remembers touching her toes and doing windmills and jumping jacks on the freshly mown grass. She remembers being the highest kicker in her class. She does not remember how to use the new coffee maker, which is now 3 years old, because it was bought after she began to forget. She does not remember asking your father 10 minutes ago if today is Sunday or if it is time to go for her ride. She does not remember where she last put her sweater or how long she has been sitting in her chair.
You're listening to Jane Atkinson, reading from Julio Tsuka's story, Diem Perditi, which we will hear later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Who Am I? Might be the unifying program title for this broadcast of two stories. The first one about someone desperately assuming a new identity, the second one a poignant depiction of a woman's struggle against a growing loss of identity. We begin with a story that was part of our program celebrating the Houghton Mifflin volume The Best American Short Stories, 2009, hosted by the volume's editor, novelist Alice Sebold. The story is The Briefcase by Rebecca Mackay, who lives near Chicago and has published stories in several small magazines. Her story is now read by Victor Garber.
He thought, how strange that a political prisoner marched through town in a line, chained to the man behind and chained to the man ahead, should take comfort in the fact that this had all happened before. He thought of other chains of men on other islands of the earth, and he thought how, since there have been men, there have been prisoners. He thought of mankind as a line of miserable monkeys chained at the wrist, dragging each other back into the ground. In the early morning of December 1st, the sun was finally warming them all enough to walk faster. With his left hand, he adjusted the loop of steel that cuffed his right hand to the line of doomed men. His hand was starved, his wrist was thin, his body was cold. The cuff slipped off. In one beat of the heart, he looked back to the man behind him and forward to the man limping ahead, and knew that neither saw his naked red wrist. Each saw only his own mother weeping in the kitchen, his own love lying on a bed in white sheets and sunlight. He walked in step with them to the end of the block. Before the war, this man had been a chef, and his one crime was feeding the people who sat at his tables in small clouds of smoke and talked politics. He served them the wine that fueled their underground newspaper, their aborted revolution. And after the night his restaurant disappeared in fire, he had run and hidden and gone without food. He who had roasted ducks until the meat jumped from the bone. He who had evaporated 3 bottles of wine into 1 pot of cream soup. He who had peeled the skin from small pumpkins with a twist of his hand. And here was his hand, twisted free of the chain. And here he was running and crawling until he was through a doorway. It was a building of empty classrooms, part of the university he had never attended. He watched from the bottom corner of a second-story window as the young soldiers stopped the line, counted 199 men, shouted to each other, shouted at the men in the panicked voices of children who barely filled the shoulders of their uniforms. One soldier, a bigger one, a louder one, stopped a man walking by, a man in a suit with a briefcase, a beard, some sort of professor. The soldiers stripped him of his coat, his shirt, his leather case, cuffed him to the chain. They marched again. And as soon as they were past, no, not that soon, many minutes later, when he had had the stomach, the chef ran down to the street and collected the man's briefcase, coat, and shirt. In the alley, the chef sat against a wall and buttoned the professor's shirt over his own ribs. When he opened the briefcase, papers flew out, 1,000 doves flailing against the walls of the alley. The chef ran after them all, stopped them with his feet and arms, herded them back into the case. Pages of numbers, of arrows and notes and hand-drawn star maps. Here were business cards, a professor of physics. Envelopes showed his name and address, information that might have been useful in some other lifetime, one where the chef could ring the bell of this man's house and explain to his wife about empty chains, empty wrists, empty classrooms. Here were graded papers, a fall syllabus, the typed draft of an exam, the question at the end, a good one. Using modern astronomical data, construct to the best of your ability a proof that the sun revolves around the earth. The chef knew nothing of physics. He understood chemistry only insofar as it related to the baking time of bread at various elevations or the evaporation rate of alcohol. His knowledge of biology was limited to the deboning of chickens and the behavior of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, common bread yeast. And what did he know at all of moving bodies and gravity? He knew this. He had moved from his line of men, creating a vacuum, one that had sucked the good professor in to fill the void. The chef sat on his bed in the Widow Kay's basement and felt in the cool leather of the briefcase a second vacuum. Here was a vacated life. Here were salary receipts, travel records, train tickets, a small address book, and these belonged to a man whose name was not blackened like his own, a man whose life was not hunted. If he wanted to live through the next year, the chef would have to learn this life and fill it. And oddly, this felt not like a robbery, but an apology, a way to put the world back in balance. The professor would not die because he himself would become the professor, and he would live. Surely he could not teach at the university. Surely he could not slip into the man's bed unnoticed. But what was in this leather case, it seemed, had been left for him to use. These addresses of friends, this card of identification, this riddle about the inversion of the universe. 5 cities east, he now gave his name as the professor's and grew out his beard so it would match the photograph on the card he now carried in his pocket. They did not anymore look entirely dissimilar. To the first man in the address book, the chef had written a typed letter. "Am in trouble and have fled the city. Tell my dear wife I am safe, but for her safety do not tell her where I am. If you are able to help a poor old man, send money to the following postbox. I hope to remain your friend, Professor T." He had to write this about the wife. How could he ask these men for money if she held a funeral? And what of it, if she kept her happiness another few months, another year? The next 26 letters were similar in nature, and money arrived now in brown envelopes and white ones. The bills came wrapped in notes. Was his life in danger? Did he have his health? And with the money, he paid another widow for another basement, and he bought weak cigarettes. He sat on cafe chairs and drew pictures of the universe, showed stars and planets looping each other in light. He felt, perhaps, that if he used the other papers in the briefcase, he must also make use of this question. Or perhaps he felt that if he could answer it, he could put the universe back together. Or perhaps it was something to do with his empty days. He wrote in his small notebook, "The light of my cigarette is a fire like the sun. From where I sit, all the universe is equidistant from my cigarette. Ergo, my cigarette is the center of the universe. My cigarette is on Earth. Ergo, the Earth is the center of the universe. If all heavenly bodies move, they must therefore move in relation to the Earth and in relation to my cigarette." His hand ached. These words were the most he had written since school, which had ended for him at age 16. He had been a smart boy, even talented in languages and mathematics, but his mother knew these were no way to make a living. He was not blessed, like the professor, with years of scholarship and quiet offices and leather books. He was blessed, instead, with chicken stocks and herbs and sherry. 30 years had passed since his last day of school, and his hand was accustomed now to wooden spoon, mandolin, peeling knife, rolling pin. Today, his hands smelled of ink, when for 30 years they had smelled of leeks. They were the hands of the professor, ergo, he was now the professor. He had written to friends A through L, and now he saved the rest and wrote instead to students. Here in the briefcase's outermost pocket were class rosters from the past 2 years. Letters addressed to those young men care of the university were sure to reach them. The amounts they sent were smaller, the notes that accompanied them more inquisitive. What exactly had transpired? Could they come to the city and meet him? The postbox, of course, was in a different city than the one where he stayed. He arrived at the post office just before closing and came only once every 2 or 3 weeks. He always looked through the window first to check that the lobby was empty. If it was not, he would leave and come again another day. Surely, one of these days, a friend of the professor would be waiting there for him. He prepared a story that he was the honored professor's assistant, that he could not reveal the man's location, but would certainly pass on your kindest regards, sir. If the earth moved, all it would take for a man to travel its distance would be a strong balloon. Rise 20 feet above and wait for the earth to turn under you, you would be home again in a day. But this was not true. And a man could not escape his spot on the earth, but to run along the surface. Ergo, the earth was still. Ergo, the sun was the moving body of the two. No, he did not believe it. He wanted only to know who this professor was, this man who would, instead of teaching his students the laws of the universe, ask them to prove as true what was false. On the wall of the cafe, plate-sized canvas, delicate oils of an apple half-peeled, signed below by a girl he had known in school. The price was more than 3 weeks of groceries, and so he did not buy it, but for weeks he read his news under the apple and drank his coffee. Staining his fingers in cheap black ink were the signal fires of the world, the distress sirens, the dispatches from the trenches and hospitals and abattoirs of the war. But here, on the wall, a sign from another world. He had known this girl as well as any other, had spoken with her every day, but had not made love to her, had gone to her home one winter holiday, but knew nothing of her life since then. And here, a clue, perfect and round and unfathomable, after all this time. Apple. After he finished the news, he worked at the proof and saw in the coil of green-edged skin some model of spiraling, of expansion. The stars were at one time part of the earth until the hand of God peeled them away, leaving us in the dark. They do not revolve around us. They escape in widening circles. The Milky Way is the edge of this peel. After 8 months in the new city, the chef stopped buying his newspapers on the street by the cafe and began instead to read the year-old news the widow gave him for his fires. Here, 14 months ago, Minister P of the Interior predicts war. One day, he found that in a box near the widow's furnace were papers 3, 4, 5 years old. Pages were missing, edges eaten. He took his fragments of yellowed paper to the cafe and read the beginnings and ends of opinions and letters. He read reports from what used to be his country's borders. When he had finished the last paper of the box, he began to read the widow's history books. The Americas before Columbus, the oceans before the British, the Romans before the fall. History was safer than the news because there was no question of how it would end. He took a lover in the city and told her he was a professor of physics. He showed her the stars in the sky and explained that they circled the earth along with the sun. "That's not true at all," she said. "You tease me because you think I'm a silly girl." "No," he said, and touched her neck. "You are the only one who might understand. The universe has been folded inside out." A full year had passed, and he paid the widow in coins. He wrote to friends M through Z. "I have been in hiding for a year," he wrote. "Tell my dear wife I have my health. May time and history forgive us all." A year had passed, but so had many years passed for many men. And after all, what was a year if the earth did not circle the sun? "The earth does not circle the sun," he wrote. "Ergo, the years do not pass. The earth, being stationary, does not erase the past nor escape towards the future. Rather, the years pile on like blankets, existing at once. The year is 1848. The year is 1789. The year is 1956. If the earth hangs still in space, does it spin? If the earth were to spin, the space I occupy will therefore vacate in an instant. This city will leave its spot, and the city to the west will usurp its place. Ergo, this city is all cities at all times. This is Kabul, this is Dresden, this is Johannesburg. I run by standing still. At the post office, he collects his envelopes of money. He has learned from the notes of concerned colleagues and students and friends that the professor suffered from infections of the inner ear that often threw his balance. He has learned of the professor's wife, A, whose father died the year they married. He has learned that he has a young son. Rather, the professor has a son. At each visit to the post office, he fears he will forget the combination. It is an old lock and complicated. F1 clockwise to B3, back to A6, forward again to J3. He must shake the little latch before it opens. More than forgetting, perhaps what he fears is that he will be denied access, that the little box will one day recognize him behind his thick and convincing beard, will decide he has no right of entry. One night, asleep with his head on his lover's leg, he dreams that a letter has arrived from the professor himself. They freed me at the end of the march, it says, and I crawled my way home. My hands are bloody, and my knees are worn through, and I want my briefcase back. In his dream, the chef takes the case and runs west. If the professor takes it back, there will be no name left for the chef. No place on the earth. The moment his fingers leave the leather loop of the handle, he will fall off the planet. He sits in a wooden chair on the lawn behind the widow's house. Inside, he hears her washing dishes. In exchange for the room, he cooks all her meals. It is March, and the cold makes the hairs rise from his arms, but the sun warms the arm beneath them. He thinks, the tragedy of a moving sun is that it leaves us each day. Hence the Aztec sacrifices, the ancient rites of the eclipse. If the sun so willingly leaves us each morning, it returns is a stay of execution, an undeserved gift. Whereas if it is we who turn, how can we so flagrantly leave behind that which has warmed us and given us light? If we are moving, then each turn is a turn away, each revolution a revolt. The money comes less often, and even his old friends who used to write monthly now send only rare apologetic notes, a few small bills. Things are more difficult now, their letters say. No one understood when he first ran away, but now it is clear, after they finished with the artists, the journalists, the fighters, they came for the professors. How wise he was to leave when he did. Some letters came back unopened with a black stamp. Life is harder here, too. Half the shops are closed. His lover has left him. The little cafe is filled with soldiers. One afternoon, he enters the post office 2 minutes before closing. The lobby is empty, but for the postman and his broom. The mailbox is empty as well, and he turns to leave, but hears the voice of the postman behind him. You are the good Professor T, no? I have something for you in the back. Yes, he says, I am the professor. And it feels as if this is true, and he will have no guilt over the professor's signature when the box is brought out. He is even wearing the professor's shirt as loose again over his hungry ribs as it was the day he slipped it on in the alley. From behind the counter, the postman brings no box, but a woman in a long gray dress, a white handkerchief in her fingers. She moves towards him, looks at his hands and his shoes and his face. Forgive me for coming, she says, and the postman pulls the cover down over his window and disappears. She says, no one would tell me anything, only that my husband had his health. And then a student gave me the number of the box and the name of the city. He begins to say, you are the widow. But why would he say this? What proof is there that the professor is dead? only that it must be, that it follows logically. She says, I don't understand what has happened. He begins to say, I am the good professor's assistant, madam. But then what next? She would ask questions he had no way to answer. I don't understand, she says again. All he can say is, this is his shirt. He holds out an arm so she can see the gaping sleeve. She says, what have you done with him? She has a calm voice and wet brown eyes. He feels he has seen her before, in the streets of the old city. Perhaps he served her a meal, a bottle of wine, perhaps in another lifetime. She was the center of his universe. This is his beard, he says. She begins to cry into the handkerchief. She says, then he is dead. He sees now from the quiet of her voice that she must have known this long ago. She has only come here to confirm. He feels the floor of the post office move beneath him, and he tries to turn his eyes from her to ground his gaze in something solid, postbox, ceiling tile, window. He finds he cannot turn away. She is a force of gravity in her long gray dress. No, he says, no, 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 no. I am right here. No, he does not believe it. But he knows that if he had time, he could prove it. And he must, because he is the only piece of the professor left alive. The woman does not see how she is murdering her husband right here in the post office lobby. He whispers to her, let me go home with you. I'll be a father to your son, and I'll warm your bed, and I'll keep you safe. He wraps his hands around her small, cold wrists, but she pulls loose. She might be the most beautiful woman he has ever seen. As if from far away, he hears her call to the postmaster to send for the police. His head is light, and he feels he might float away from the post office forever. It is an act of will not to fly off, to hold tight to the earth and wait. If the police aren't too busy to come, he feels confident he can prove to them that he is the professor. He has the papers, after all, and in the havoc of war, what else will they have time to look for? She is backing away from him on steady feet, and he feels it like a peeling off of skin. If not the police, perhaps he'll convince a city judge. The witnesses who would denounce him are mostly gone or killed, and the others would fear to come before the law. If the city judge will not listen, he can prove it to the high court. One day, he might try to convince the professor's own child. He feels certain that somewhere down the line, someone will believe him.
Victor Garber read Rebecca Mackay's story, The Briefcase. I had a chance to speak with Rebecca Mackay by telephone from her home in Chicago. Rebecca, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Some people have said, is this really by a young American woman? This is a Gogol story. This is a Chekhov story. It has a very European feel to it because it's set in a not named European country where there's political oppression. But were you reading Gogol or Chekhov or somebody else from Eastern Europe?
I'm impressed. I was reading Gogol, yeah. I'm impressed that you figured that out. I had just read The Overcoat, and it was, you know, more a tone than anything else that I really liked there.
Well, it's only a short distance from The Overcoat to The Briefcase.
Well, and the title, I think, was definitely an homage. That was conscious on my part. And the idea of sort of a man wandering very alone. And actually, I have to say, I do feel it has a European tone to it. I'm not convinced that the story takes place in Europe. There's a point in the story where he goes through the different cities on the earth where he might be. To me, it's any city at any point in history where there's been a state of revolution, and that really encompasses most of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us something of a backstage view for our listeners about just how this story was written?
Actually, actually, it's funny. Usually I write slowly, and this story came out very quickly. I remember there's a coffee house where I go to write. I always hate to admit this because it makes it sound as if I rushed, but I probably wrote it over 3 or 4 days, which is very unusual for me. It often takes me several months to write a story. It sort of came out all at once, and I remember feeling, even when I went home and even when I had stopped writing, I remember feeling as if I were in a sort of a trance, and I would snap at my husband whenever he tried to say anything to me because I didn't want to lose this feeling of the story that I was living in. And although it's very surreal and kind of a creepy world that they're in, this is a true story in a way. There was a distant relative of mine who was on the other side of this story, who was pulled into a chain gang to take the place of an escaped prisoner. And that was someone I never knew, but I have relatives who did know him. And I did feel a tremendous amount of guilt writing this story. I don't know if those people have even read the story, and if they do, I apologize to them. I feel like it's something that I've stolen in a very fundamental way, although that's the only true part of it. It's just that one detail.
Tell me what it was like to sit in an audience at Symphony Space and hear your wonderful story read on stage.
It was fabulous. Victor Garber did the most amazing job I could have imagined. He really brought the story to life and brought out aspects of it that I couldn't have imagined. I think particularly the emotion with which he read it was something that you can't quite put on the page in the same way that an actor can bring voice to it.
But what in particular in the story did he, in his reading, reveal to you, the author?
The desperation of the main character came through, and I think what he managed to do also in his reading that I had hoped was there in the story was convey that this is essentially a good person. My main character is someone who does some really horribly unconscionable things out of necessity to stay alive and to ease his own conscience. It gave me permission to like my character when I haven't always liked that character.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. Now, we're often told by writers that writing is a lonely occupation, alone in a room with your pencil and pad or your computer. And here you are sitting in a 900-seat theater surrounded by people, fans. Some of your friends were there with you. What did you make of the public experience of having your work out there?
It was amazing to hear people breathe together. Something that I think does happen, especially in theater, not because they're all surprised necessarily at the same moment. They're almost breathing with the actor, and they're stopping at the same point to process a thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're out of time, but I want to thank you, Rebecca Mackay, author of The Briefcase, for giving us a backstage look into how that story came about. Thanks so much. See you soon. That was the writer Rebecca Mackay. We'll hear a story by Julie Otsuka after a short break. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our second story on this broadcast was part of an evening celebrating the young writers who hang out and write in the Hungarian Pastry Shop Cafe near the Columbia University campus, a few blocks north of Symphony Space. The story is Julie Otsuka's Diem Perdidi. Shorts listeners may well remember hearing Julie Otsuka's story When the Emperor Was Divine, about her Japanese-American family's experience in the internment camps during World War II. Now Otsuka turns to a poignant, poetical portrait of her mother's heartbreaking and gradual loss of memory. The Latin phrase diem perdidi, which the mother in the story still does remember, means I have lost the day. The reader is the Broadway actress Jane Atkinson.
She remembers her name. She remembers the name of the president. She remembers the name of the president's dog. She remembers what city she lives in and on which street and in which house. The one with the big olive tree where the road takes a turn. She remembers what year it is. She remembers the season. She remembers which day you were born. She remembers the daughter who was born before you. She had your father's nose. That was the first thing I noticed about her. But she does not remember that daughter's name. She remembers the name of the man she did not marry, George. And she keeps his letters in a drawer by her bed. She remembers that you once had a husband, but she refuses to remember your ex-husband's name. That man, she calls him. She does not remember how she got the bruises on her arms or going for a walk with you earlier this morning. She does not remember bending over during that walk and plucking a flower from a neighbor's front yard and slipping it into her hair. Maybe your father will kiss me now. She does not remember what she ate for dinner last night or when she last took her medicine. She does not remember to drink enough water. She does not remember to comb her hair. She remembers the rows of dried persimmons that once hung from the eaves of her mother's house in Berkeley. They were the most beautiful shade of orange, she tells you. She remembers that your father loves peaches. She remembers that every Sunday morning at 10, he takes her for a drive down to the sea in the brown car. She remembers that every evening, right before the 8 o'clock news, he sets out 2 fortune cookies on a paper plate and announces to her that they are having a party. She remembers that on Mondays, he comes home from the college at 4, and if he is 5 minutes late, she goes out to the gate to wait for him. She remembers which bedroom is hers, which bedroom is his. She remembers that the bedroom that is now hers was once yours. She remembers that it always wasn't like this. She remembers the first line of the song, How High the Moon. She remembers the Pledge of Allegiance. She remembers her Social Security number. She remembers her best friend Jean's telephone number, even though Jean has been dead for 6 years. She remembers that Margaret is dead. She remembers that Betty is dead. She remembers that Grace has stopped calling. She remembers that her own mother died 9 years ago while spading the soil in her garden, and she misses her more every day. It doesn't go away, she tells you. She remembers the number assigned to her family by the government right after the start of the war, 13611. She remembers being sent away to the desert with her mother and her brother during the 5th month of that war and taking her first ride on a train. She remembers the day they came home, September 9th, 1945. She remembers the sound of the wind hissing through the sagebrush. She remembers the scorpions and red ants. She remembers the taste of dust. Whenever you stop by to see her, she remembers to give you a big hug, and you are always surprised at her strength. She remembers to give you a kiss every time you leave. She remembers to tell you at the end of every phone call, the FBI will check up on you. She remembers to ask you if you would like her to iron your blouse for you before you go out on a date. She remembers to smooth down your skirt. Don't give it all away, she says. She remembers to brush aside a wayward strand of your hair. She does not remember eating lunch with you a half hour ago and suggests that you go out to Marie Callender's for some sandwiches and pie. She does not remember that she herself once used to make the most beautiful pies with perfectly fluted crusts. She does not remember how to iron your blouse for you or when she began to forget. Some things changed, she says. She does not remember what she's supposed to do next. She remembers that the daughter who was born before you lived for half an hour and then died. She looked perfect from the outside, she says. She remembers her mother telling her more than once, "Don't you ever let anyone see you cry." She remembers giving you your first bath on your third day in the world. She remembers that you were a very fat baby. She remembers that your first word was no. She remembers picking apples in a field with George many years ago in the rain. It was the best day of my life. She remembers that the first time she met him, she was so nervous she forgot her own address. She remembers wearing too much lipstick. She remembers not sleeping for days. When you drive past Hess Park, she remembers being asked to leave her class by her teacher after being in that class for more than 10 years. "I shouldn't have talked so much," she says. She remembers touching her toes and doing windmills and jumping jacks on the freshly mown grass. She remembers being the highest kicker in her class. She does not remember how to use the new coffee maker, which is now 3 years old, because it was bought after she began to forget. She does not remember asking your father 10 minutes ago if today is Sunday or if it is time to go for her ride. She does not remember where she last put her sweater or how long she has been sitting in her chair. She does not always remember how to get out of the chair, and so you gently push down on the footrest and offer your hand, which she does not always remember to take. "Go away," she sometimes says. Other times she just says, "I'm stuck." She does not remember saying to you the other night, right after your father left the room, "He loves me more than I love him." She does not remember saying to you a moment later, "I can hardly wait for him to come back." She remembers that when your father was courting her, he was always on time. She remembers thinking that he had a nice smile. He still does. She remembers that when they first met, he was engaged to another woman. She remembers that the other woman was white. She remembers that the other woman's parents did not want their daughter to marry a man who looked like the gardener. She remembers that the winters were colder back then and that there were days on which you actually had to put on a coat and scarf. She remembers her mother bowing her head every morning at the altar and offering her ancestors a bowl of rice. She remembers the smell of incense and pickled cabbage in the kitchen. She remembers that her father always wore very nice shoes. She remembers that night that the FBI came for him, and he and her mother had just had another big fight. She remembers not seeing him again until after the end of the war. She does not always remember to trim her toenails. And when you soak her feet in the bucket of warm water, she closes her eyes and leans back in her chair and reaches out for your hand. "Don't give up on me," she says. She does not remember how to tie her shoelaces or fasten the hooks on her bra. She does not remember that she has been wearing her favorite blue blouse for 5 days now. She does not remember your age. "Well, just wait till you have children of your own," she says, even though you are now too old to do so. She remembers that after the first girl was born and then died, she sat in the yard for days just staring at the roses by the pond. "I didn't know what else to do," she says. She remembers that when you were born, you too had your father's long nose. "It was as if I had given birth to the same girl twice," she says. She remembers that you are a Taurus. She remembers that your birthstone is green. She remembers to read you your horoscope from the newspaper whenever you come over to see her. "You will soon meet a dark and handsome man," she tells you. She does not remember reading you that same horoscope 5 minutes ago, or going to the doctor with you last week after you discovered a bump on the back of her head. I think I fell, she says. She does not remember telling the doctor that you are no longer married, or giving him your number and asking him to call. She does not remember leaning over and whispering to you the moment he stepped out of the room, "I think he'll do." She remembers another doctor asking her 50 years ago, minutes after the first girl was born and then died, if she wanted to donate the baby's body to science. He said that she had a very unusual heart. She remembers being in labor for 32 hours. She remembers being too tired to think. "So I told him yes," she says. She remembers driving home from the hospital in the sky blue Chevy, and neither one of them saying a word. She remembers knowing that she made a big mistake. She does not remember what happened to the baby's body and worries that it might be stuck in a jar. She does not remember why they didn't just bury her. "I wish she were under a tree," she says. She remembers wanting to bring her flowers every day. She remembers that even as a young girl, you said that you didn't want to have children. She remembers that you hated wearing dresses. She remembers that you never played with dolls. She remembers that the first time you bled, you were 13 years old and wearing bright yellow pants. She remembers that your childhood dog was named Shiro. She remembers that you once had a cat named Gasoline. She remembers that you had two turtles, both named Turtle. She remembers that the first time she and your father took you to Japan to meet his family, you were 18 months old and just beginning to speak. She remembers leaving you with his mother in the village while she and your father traveled across the island for 10 days. "I worried about you the whole time." She remembers that when they came back to you, you did not know who she was, and that for many days afterwards, you would not speak to her, you would only whisper in her ear. She remembers that the year you turned 5, you refused to leave the house without tapping the doorframe 3 times. She remembers that you had a habit of clicking your teeth repeatedly, which drove her up the wall. She remembers that you could not stand it when different colored foods were touching on the plate. Everything had to be just so. She remembers trying to teach you to read before you were ready. She remembers taking you to Newbury's to pick out a pattern and fabric and teaching you how to sew. She remembers that every night after dinner, you would sit down next to her at the kitchen table and hand her the bobby pins, one by one, as she set the curlers in her hair. She remembers that this was her favorite part of the day. "I wanted to be with you all the time." She remembers that when you were conceived was on the first try. She remembers that your brother was conceived on the first try. She remembers that your other brother was conceived on the second try. "We must not have been paying attention." She remembers that a palm reader once told her that she would never be able to bear children because her uterus was tipped the wrong way. She remembers that a blind fortune teller once told her that she had been a man in a past life and that George had been her sister. She remembers that everything she remembers is not necessarily true. She remembers the horse-drawn garbage carts on Ashby, her first pair of crepe-soled shoes, scattered flowers by the side of the road. She remembers the sound of George's voice always made her feel calmer. She remembers that every time they parted, he turned around and watched her walk away. She remembers that the first time he asked her to marry him, she said she wasn't ready. She remembers that the second time, she said she wanted to wait until she was finished with school. She remembers walking along the water with him one warm summer evening on the boardwalk and being so happy that she could not even remember her own name. She remembers not knowing that it wouldn't be like this with any of the others. She remembers thinking that she had all the time in the world. She does not remember the names of the flowers in the yard, whose names she has known for years: Cosmos, Forsythia, Wisteria, Immortals. She does not remember that today is Sunday and that she has already gone for her ride. She does not remember to call you, even though she says that she will. She remembers how to play Clair de Lune on the piano. She remembers how to play chopsticks and scales. She remembers not to talk to the telemarketers when they call on the phone. "We're not interested," she says. She remembers her grammar, just between you and me. She remembers her manners. She remembers to say thank you and please. She remembers to wipe herself every time she uses the toilet. She remembers to turn her wedding ring around every time she pulls on her silk stockings. She remembers to reapply her lipstick every time she leaves the house. She remembers to put on her anti-wrinkle cream every night before she climbs into bed. "It works while you sleep," she says. In the morning, when she wakes, she remembers her dreams. "I was walking through a forest. I was swimming in a river. I was looking for George in a city I did not know, and no one would tell me where he was." On Halloween day, she remembers to ask you if you're going trick-or-treating. She remembers that your father hates pumpkin. It's all he ate during the war. She remembers listening him to pray every night when they first got married, that he would be the first one to die. She remembers playing marbles on a dirt floor in the desert with her brother and listening to the couple at night on the other side of the wall. They were at it all the time. She remembers the box of chocolates you brought back to her after your honeymoon in Paris. "Will it last?" she asks you. She remembers her own mother telling her, "The moment you fall in love with someone, you're lost." She remembers that when her father came back after the war, he and her mother fought even more than they had before. She remembers that he would spend entire days shopping for shoes in San Francisco while her mother scrubbed other people's floors. She remembers that some nights he would walk around the block 3 times before coming into the house. She remembers that one night he did not come in at all. She remembers that when your own husband left you 5 years ago, you broke out into hives all over your body for weeks. She remembers thinking he was trouble from the moment she set eyes on him. A mother knows. She remembers keeping that thought to herself. "I had to let you make your own mistakes," she says. She remembers that of her 3 children, you were the most delightful to be with. She remembers that your younger brother never cried. "He was like a dream," she says. She remembers that her own brother refused to carry anything with him onto the train except for his transistor radio. He didn't want to miss any of the good shows. She remembers her mother killing all the chickens in the yard the day before they left. She remembers her 5th grade teacher, Mr. Huber, asking her to stand up in front of the class so everyone could tell her goodbye. She remembers being given a silver heart pendant by her next-door neighbor, Elaine Crowley, who promised to write, but never did. She remembers losing that pendant on the train and being so angry she wanted to cry. "It was my first piece of jewelry." She remembers that 1 month after George joined the Air Force, he suddenly stopped writing her letters. She remembers worrying that he'd been shot down over Korea or taken hostage by guerrillas in the jungle. She remembers thinking about him every minute of the day. "I thought I was losing my mind," she says. She remembers learning from a friend one night that he had fallen in love with somebody else. She remembers asking your father the next day to marry her. "Shall we go get the ring?" I said to him. She remembers telling him, "It's time." She remembers that it never was. When you take her to the supermarket, she remembers that coffee is in aisle 2. She remembers that aisle 3 is milk. She remembers the name of the cashier in the express lane who always gives her a hug, Diane. She remembers the name of the girl at the flower stand who always gives her a single broken-stemmed rose. She remembers that the man behind the meat counter is Big Lou. "Well, hello, gorgeous," he says to her. She does not remember where her purse is, and she begins to panic until you remind her that she left it at home. "I don't feel myself without it," she tells you. She does not remember asking the man in line behind her whether he is married or not. She does not remember staring at the old woman in the wheelchair by the melons and whispering to you, "I hope I never end up like that." She remembers that the huge mimosa tree that once stood next to the cart corral in the parking lot is no longer there. "Nothing stays the same," she says. She remembers that she was once a very good driver. She remembers failing her last driver's test 3 times in a row. "I couldn't remember any of the rules." She remembers that the day after her father left them, her mother sprinkled little piles of salt in the corner of every room to purify the house. She remembers that they never spoke of him again. She does not remember asking your father, when he comes home from the pharmacy, what took him so long, or who he talked to, and whether she was pretty. She does not always remember his name. She remembers graduating from high school with honors in Latin. She remembers how to say, "I came, I saw, I conquered." Veni, vidi, vici. She remembers to say, "I have lost the day." Diem, perdidi. She remembers the words for "I'm sorry" in Japanese, which you have not heard her utter in years. She remembers the words for rice and toilet. She remembers the word for wait, choto mate kudasai. She remembers that a white snake dream will bring you good luck. She remembers that it is bad luck to pick up a dropped comb. She remembers that you should never run to a funeral. She remembers that you should shout the truth down a well. She remembers going to work like her mother for the rich white ladies up in the hills. She remembers Mrs. Tyndall, who insisted on eating lunch with her every day in the kitchen instead of just leaving her alone. She remembers Mrs. Edward DeYoung, who fired her after one day. "Who taught you how to iron?" she asked me. She remembers that Mrs. Vannevar would not let her go home on Saturdays until she'd baked an apple pie. She remembers Mrs. Vannevar's husband, Arthur, who liked to put his hand on her knee. She remembers that he sometimes gave her money. She remembers that she never said no. She remembers once stealing a silver candlestick from a cupboard, but she cannot remember who it was. She remembers that they never missed it. She remembers using the same napkin for 3 days in a row. She remembers that today is Sunday, which 6 days out of 7 is not true. When you bring home the man who will one day become your next husband, she remembers to take his jacket. She remembers to offer him coffee. She remembers to offer him cake. She remembers to thank him for the roses. "So you like her?" she asks him. She remembers to ask his name. "She's my firstborn, you know." She remembers 5 minutes later that she has already forgotten his name and asks him again what it is. "That's my brother's name," she tells him. She does not remember talking to her brother on the phone earlier that morning. He never calls. Or going for a walk with you in the park. She does not remember how to make coffee. She does not remember how to serve cake. She remembers sitting next to her brother many years ago on a train to the desert and fighting about who got to lie down on the seat. She remembers hot, white sand, the wind on the water, someone's voice telling her, "Hush, hush. It's all right." She remembers where she was the day the men landed on the moon. She remembers the day they learned that Japan had lost the war. "It was the only time that I saw my mother cry," she says. She remembers the day she learned that George had married somebody else. "I read about it in the paper." She remembers the letter she got from him not long after, asking to please see her. He said that he'd made a mistake. She remembers writing him back. It's too late. She remembers marrying your father on a warm day in April. She remembers having their first fight 2 months later in June. I threw a chair. She remembers that he comes home from college every Monday at 4. She remembers that she is forgetting. She remembers less and less every day. When you ask her your name, she does not remember. Ask your father, she says. He'll know. She does not remember the name of the president. She does not remember the name of the president's dog. She does not remember the season. She does not remember the day or year. She remembers the little house on Los Palos Avenue that she first lived in with your father. She remembers her mother leaning over the bed she once shared with her brother and kissing the two of them goodnight. She remembers that as soon as the first girl was born, she knew that something was wrong. She didn't cry. She remembers holding the baby in her arms and watching her go to sleep for the first and last time in her life. She remembers they never buried her. She remembers they did not give her a name. She remembers that the baby had perfect fingernails and a very unusual heart. She remembers that she had your father's long nose. She remembers knowing at once that she was his. She remembers beginning to bleed 2 days later when she came home from the hospital. She remembers your father catching her in the bathroom as she began to fall. She remembers a desert sky at sunset. It was the most beautiful shade of orange. She remembers scorpions and ants. She remembers the taste of dust. She remembers once loving someone more than anyone else. She remembers that today is Sunday, and it's time to go for her ride. And so she picks up her purse, puts on her lipstick, and goes out to wait for your father in the car.
Jane Atkinson read Giulio Zucca's Diem Perdidi. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs, presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.